This podcast is really only of interest for people in Perth, Western Australia, and then perhaps even more specifically of interest to people who went to the University of Western Australia at some point in their life, if only for a visit. I just had a chat with George Seddon, who is a writer on native plants and issues around gardening and landscapes, and author of a book called A Landscape for Learning about the grounds to UWA, the University of Western Australia. And just before I go over to that chat, I thought I'd read a little bit from his chapter Noongar Landscape. And this is the first chapter of his book A Landscape for Learning. He talks about the Noongars in the area near Crawley hunting kangaroos, and King's Park apparently was one such hunting ground where the animals were driven over the cliffs. And I'll just read a little bit. He says, women dog for tubers, zamia nuts, Macrozamia reedley, were stored for use, and nectar-rich flowers and honeycomb were steeped in water to produce a heady liquor. The smaller marsupials would have been there too. Quokkas, quenders, woolies, bilbies, possums, brush-tailed and ring-tailed, along with tiny honey possums, the last specimen of which was collected in Chenton Park in 1941. Honey dibblers and wallabies. At that stage, there were no cats or foxes, whose subsequent introduction has been so destructive. People still go crabbing and prawning in Matilda Bay today. That's the bay just in front of UWA. But they're more likely to bring their own heady liquor with them. The Noongars were catching tortoises and crabs in the area. And for them, the area where UWA now stands must have been a well-stocked larder. There were, and still are, land birds in plenty. The seed eaters, insect eaters, nectar eaters, striated pardalopes, singing honey eaters, little brown honey eaters, and Port Lincoln parrots, locally known as 28s. The Noongars would probably have seen more ground birds like the wrens and willy wagtails, perhaps even emus, but no kookaburras like we see today, no Senegal doves or pigeons, and only a few ravens, indigenous but now superabundant. Magpies would have been common, but feeding on native insect larvae instead of introduced earthworms, as is now the case. Currawongs would also have inhabited the forested parts around the Swan. He goes on to say, Crawley was a cultural centre. This is the area where UWA stands for the Noongar people because of the plentiful food supply. He said that Aboriginal groups travelled from country areas to trade items here, including weapons, spears, knives, ornaments, ceremonial paint, headdresses, shields, digging sticks, spear throwers, skin garments and bags. He says ceremonies included exchanging fire, marriage preparation and betrothal, initiation, educational exchange, recreational activities, and demonstrations of etiquette such as friendship compacts, conferring of titles and corroborees. He says the landscape has changed, yet many of the social activities listed above persist in forms altered to the present day. Indeed they do. Just before I go on to the talk, I noticed at a later section of the book, he mentions the tropical grove. If you know the UWA campus, you know there's a grove of tropical-looking trees in the centre of the campus, which create a cathedral-like space of green leaves and white trunks. It's a beautiful area, and George lists some of the plants there. He says they include the plants in the grove include the Kaffir plum, the hoop pine. I think that one, the hoop pine's from Queensland. The camphor laurel and the silky oak. There's another fruiting tree in the tropical grove, the Queensland plum pine, Podocarpus elatus. And The plum pine and the kauri pine both have their major distribution in southern to central Queensland, although they do extend to the tropics. Other tree species in the tropical grove include several brachycheton species, two species of macadamia, a New Zealand kauri pine, that is Agathis australis, and four Illawarra flame trees, and the kentia palms add to the tropical effect. So those are some of the trees in the tropical grove. I might, if I get time, go and take some photos of some of those, because they're very beautiful trees. Over to George.
Is it because of the soil, or?
I've told you about this before.
I'm not sure.
Well, soils, the same soils as the soils of the Cattle Chosen,
home of the Bustle family.
Yes. Remember, the soils of the Cattle Chosen came up from Augusta. There's nothing but these here. And they settle upon the banks of the Bass, and these are called the Bass soils, and they're very rich alluvial soils. And the alluvial soils are at the university, and this is the only large area of alluvial soil, of the Bass soils, I should say, in the whole, area. And the reason they're there, when you think about it, damned obvious, but nobody has picked up this fact, except that I had some recollections of a friend of mine out there who's a soil scientist who did the mapping for the soil science and mapped up the whole metropolitan area, and he had these vast soils. I had some recollection, and I checked back with his map, and yes, lo and behold, that's what they are. and of course, you can think about it only for the moment. It's a number of things become very obvious. The first one is that the Canning, until the Canning Dam in 1932, I think it was, used to flood every year. Water used to pour down because the swamps and the rivers, it's an estuary. The Canning was a river, and it's the Canning Dam, but before the dam, when the canning enters the swamp, north, and it bends into Nunwasik, whoops, around the corner, slows down when it gets to Matilda Bay, with real flood, then flood up and over the levee, which any flooding river builds, on which our current and then the land behind that was swampy and the deposit of silt, and it's been doing that for about at least 10,000 years, no, 8,000 years before they received any changes, etc. So that deposit of deep alluvial soils, very fertile. When they put in the new university club, they have to excavate about 20 feet deep and have a marvellous opportunity to actually see the profile of these soils. They're like valves in three. I've got some photographs, but I knew it was that anyhow. And that explains not only the so called tropical grove and the luxuriance of the growth there, but everything else on campus and its history. Because it was the favoured camping place for the Noongar in the metropolitan area in the summer, because it was the only place that had green pick in the summer.
It had what, sir?
Green pick, what the kangaroos are looking for, and the wallabies, all those things. So they'd come out of dry as dust surrounding Midlands and King's Park, etc. And they'd be down at, on the university land. And also, of course, there are lots of swamps that were teeming with journeys and all those things. Cordy Bay itself was very productive because it was shallow and silty. And because of that, this was the annual meeting place for the Noongar from right down the metropolitan area, because it was the only place in summer, in the centre of January, or January in particular, where there was enough to eat for a group of more than two people for more than 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
So what did they do? They had their Noongar University, in other words, they rehearsed their tribal traditions, and they played cricket on Riley Oval, James Oval, I should say.
Threw a boomerang through the bush,
well,
in other words.
But I mean, same equipment. Initiated the young. Exactly what we do.
Yeah.
And I think that's really one of the most interesting things about the university site. And what is amazing is that nobody from the university had ever picked, and it was not my discovery, it was only, my good sense in checking on the soils.
So was the site chosen because it, did its choice have anything to do with the luxuriance of the flora there?
No, it's all I could get. Nobody wanted too far out.
Yeah.
There's a long story in the book about all the hassles about choosing the site. No, they had about four or five other sites, and this is the only one that they could get. And most of them were very hostile. It's even originally the site of Grafton Town. And our current sports thing, maybe a play building on the west side of Great Leather, that was part of the original university in town.
Of course, right. So, where do you think the most interesting areas are botanically on the campus? Because there's the botanic garden on the southern, towards the southern end of the campus.
You really don't have time to read this, which is pretty.
So you have a whole chapter devoted to the botany on campus.
Yes. I mean, the book is primarily about the landscape.
The landscape,
it's
of
not about
landscape
history,
for
not
learning.
The history of the university. It is about the landscape.
But you haven't written the whole thing, have you?
In effect, yes. I had various other people whose names are, but with two exceptions. I had, well, certainly for the landscape architects, I had to completely rewrite this stuff. People couldn't write the themes. That's Gene Fisher and James. So I wrote those. I wrote the chapter, the main garden, but I put their names on it. Basil Barr wrote his.
So the organisation of the book is a chronological look at the development of the grounds,
yes,
rather than,
yes,
focusing on different species of plants or that kind of approach. Right. And so there are a few Australian rainforest species in the
place. There are some original plants there. I mean, once they've changed the site. But look, if you go behind, which is to say to the south of the library, there are the best Mary that you see anywhere in the metropolitan area. They are magnificent trees.
They
straight
are.
Trunks, tall, umbrageous. You know, really top canopy, etc. Most of the Mary on the coastal plain is relatively dwarfed. Quite often the trunk bifurcates, or, you know, like that, fairly early, which is a sign for mutant trees. And we've been exposed to that. all in their own. Why the hell have we got the best married in the metropolitan area behind the library? Well, that's why.
Soils again.
Yeah, soils and moisture, of course, too. It's there all the time. It's down the way. I'd work for it.
I was in North Queensland last year, September. I arrived in Cairns and then went up into the Atherton Tablelands and then went down to Mosman and north to Daintree and then to Cape Tribulation, as I'm sure many tourists do. But I was noticing that there were around 600 species of tree in the Daintree rainforest. So, and I wander around, look at the trunks, all of them look to be exactly the same to me.
That's the problem with rainforests. It's often pretty difficult to identify things. You find flowers on the ground occasionally, but you're not quite sure which tree they come from. So matching trunk and bark and leaf, which you need, but flowers are the key to identify the direction. Yeah, it's a bugger.
It's probably easier in a place like at UWA, where you've got the tree actually. It's a big old tree and it's by itself. Found that also the case when I was in Sydney, in the Sydney Botanic Gardens.
Yeah.
There's some beautiful trees from southeast Queensland in the Sydney Botanic Gardens.
Yeah.
And they're much easier to identify because they're not in the thick canopy.
Yeah, they've got names on them.
As well. That's excellent, yeah. If you wouldn't mind if I borrowed this for a few minutes, that'd be great.
Yes, but if you're going away, you
No, a week.
Yeah, that's
not even my topic. Oh,
okay.
Yes. Maybe when I get back, I'll. You don't have a copy? I didn't give you a copy. What an injustice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know how it is.
Yeah, they're about $65 or something. I don't know, I'm glad you finished with that book. Something that I find quite entertaining, I had that in as a keep the place, that's all, just to show you the bit I wanted to show you, but that's okay, it's not just the plan. But about how it's a bit of scrap paper, and they're my publications for last year.
My friend Holly Story lent me something he wrote, Landscapes of the Swan River.
Oh, yes. Swan River Landscapes.
Swan River Landscapes.
Yeah.
1970, 71.
Yeah.
And
that's my third book.
I looked through and I was looking at all these photos of Perth and the River foreshore in 1970 or a few years before then. And there were far fewer houses,
yeah.
Much less development along the river, and particularly in places like Buckland Hill.
Oh, yes.
And
do you remember the figures on Buckland Hill, the children? You find my children throughout.
I do. They're your children.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's my best book, I should stop there. And maybe they're right.
No, I actually think, I mean, I haven't read everything you've written, but I definitely enjoyed one of your most recent ones, the one before Landscape for Learning, The Old Country.
Oh, yes. That's right, yes. Well, that's okay.
I like the, you have a photograph in that book of a Boab. Etched into the Boab is 1820, I think.
Oh, yes. Into the Boab, yeah, that's good, 1826.
Yeah. Some English explorer.
Which, of course, I went to see. I mean, I went, there's nothing that I describe in any of my books that I have not seen with my own eyes.
And you've taken a lot of your own photos. You've taken many of your own photos as well.
Yeah, a lot.
Yeah.
But up in the Daintree, now I've got something on the Daintree and something or other that I wrote. Colin Totterdale was my photographer. He used to work for CSIRO, and his best nature photographer, the equivalent of Ansel Adams.